Jim's agonized whisper, "Melancurian," and he knew that the moon was full red, stained as if its defilement were complete, as bloody as if the night sky had been cut to the heart. He felt the light touch his face, and his cheek twitched in revulsion. The next moment there came a distant wail like a cry of protest. It throbbed like desolation in the chill air. In spite of himself, Covenant looked over the blood-hued plain. For an instant, he expected the company to leap to the relief of that call. But no one moved. The cry must have come from some animal. Glancing briefly at the full, violated moon, he changed his grip and lowered his eyes again. When his gaze reached his fingers, he saw in horror that the moonlight gave his ring a reddish cast. The metal looked as if it had been dipped in blood. Its inner silver struggled to show through the crimson, but the blood light seemed to be soaking inward, slowly quenching, perverting the white gold. He understood instinctively. For one staggering heartbeat, he sat still, howled silent and futile warnings at his unsuspecting self. Then he sprang to his feet, erect and rigid as if he had been yanked upright by the moon, arms tight at his sides, fists clenched. Behind him, Banner said, "Do not fear, Urlord. The Ranahin will warn us if the wolves are any danger." Covenant turned his head. The blood guard reached a restraining hand toward him. "Don't touch me," Covenant hissed. He jerked away from Banner. For an instant, while his heart labored, he observed how the crimson moon made Banner's face look like old lava. Then a vicious sense of wrong exploded under his feet, and he pitched toward the fire. As he struck the earth, he flung himself onward, careless of everything but his intense, visceral need to escape the attack. After one roll, his legs crashed among the flaming brands. But as Covenant fell, Banner sprang forward. When Covenant hit the fire, the blood guard was only a stride away. He caught Covenant's wrist in almost the same instant, heaved him, child light, out of the flames and onto his feet. Even before he had regained his balance, Covenant spun on Banner and yelled into the blood guard's face, "Don't touch me!" Banner released Covenant's wrist, backed away a step. Prothol, Morum, Foam Follower, and all the warriors were on their feet. They stared at Covenant in surprise, confusion, outrage. He felt suddenly weak. His legs trembled. He dropped to his knees beside the fire, thinking, "Hellfire and bloody Fowl has done it to me. He's taking me over. Damnation!" He pointed an unsteady finger at the ground that had stung him. "There," he gasped. "It was there. I felt it." The lords reacted immediately. While Morum shouted for Birinair, Prothol hurried forward and stooped over the spot Covenant indicated. Mumbling softly to himself, he touched the spot with the tips of his fingers like a physician testing a wound. Then he was joined by Morum and Birinair. Birinair thrust the High Lord aside, took his Lilianril staff, and placed its end on the sore place. Rotating the staff between his palms, he concentrated imperiously on his beloved wood. "For one moment," Prothol murmured, "for one moment I felt something, some memory in the earth. Then it passed beyond my touch." He sighed. "It was terrible." Birinair echoed, "Terrible," talking to himself in his concentration. Prothol and Morum watched him as his hands trembled with either age or sensitivity. Abruptly he cried, "Terrible! The hand of the Slayer! He dares do this!" He snatched himself away so quickly that he stumbled and would have fallen if Prothol had not caught him. Momentarily, Prothol and Birinair met each other's eyes as if they were trying to exchange some knowledge that could not be voiced. Then Birinair shook himself free. Looking about him as if he could see the shards of his dignity scattered around his feet, he mumbled gruffly, "Stand on my own. Not that old yet." After a glance at Covenant, he went on more loudly, "You think I am old?" "Of course, old and foolish. Push himself into a quest when he should be resting his bones by the hearth. Like a lump." Pointing toward the unbeliever, he concluded, Ask him. Ask. Covenant had climbed to his feet while the attention of the company was on the Hirebrand, and had pushed his hands into his pockets to hide the hue of his ring. As Birinair pointed at him, he raised his eyes from the ground. A sick feeling of presage twisted his stomach as he remembered his attacks in Andalain, and what had followed them. Prothol said firmly, "Step there again, Ur-Lord." Grimacing, Covenant strode forward and stamped his foot on the spot. As his heel hit the ground, he winced in expectation, tried to brace himself for the sensation that at this one point the earth had become insecure, foundationless. But nothing stung him. As in Andalain, the ill had vanished, leaving him with the impression that a veneer of trustworthiness had been replaced over a pit. In answer to the silent question of the lords, he shook his head. After a pause, Morum said evenly, "You have felt this before." With an effort, Covenant forced himself to say, "Yes, several times. In Andalain. Before that attack on the celebration." "The hand of the Grey Slayer touched you," Birinair spat. But he could not sustain his accusation. His bones seemed to remember their age, and he sagged tiredly, leaned on his staff. In an odd tone of self-reproach, as if he were apologizing, he mumbled, "Of course, younger. If I were younger." He turned from the company and shuffled away to his bed beyond the circle. "Why did you not tell us?" Morum asked severely. The question made Covenant feel suddenly ashamed, as if his ring were visible through the fabric of his pants. His shoulders hunched, drove his hands deeper into his pockets. "I didn't. At first I didn't want you to know how important, foul, and drool think I am. After that," he referred to his crisis in the close with his eyes, "I was thinking about other things." Morum accepted this with a nod, and after a moment, Covenant went on. "I don't know what it is, but I only get it through my boots. I can't touch it with my hands or my feet." Morum and Prothol shared a glance of surprise. Shortly, the High Lord said, "Unbeliever, the cause of these attacks surpasses me. Why do your boots make you sensitive to this wrong?" "I do not know. But either Lord Morum or myself must remain by you at all times, so that we may respond without delay." Over his shoulder he said, "First Mark Tufor, Warhaft Quan. Have you heard?" Quan came to attention and replied, "Yes, High Lord." And from behind the circle Tuvor's voice carried softly, "There will be an attack. We have heard." "Readiness will be needed," said Morum grimly, "and stout hearts to face an onslaught of Ur-Vials and wolves and cave-wights without faltering." "That is so," the High Lord said at last. "But such things will come in their own time. Now, we must rest. We must gather strength." Slowly the company began the busyness of bedding down. Humming his giantish plainsong, Foam Follower stretched out on the ground with his arm around his leather flask of diamond draught. While the blood guards set watches, the warriors spread blankets for themselves and the lords. Covenant went to bed self-consciously, as if he felt the company studying him, and he was glad of the blankets that helped him hide his ring. Then he lay awake long into the night, feeling too cold to sleep. The blankets did not keep out the chill which emanated from his ring. But until he finally fell asleep, he could hear Foam Followers humming and see Prothol sitting by the embers of the fire. The giant and the High Lord kept watch together, two old friends of the land sharing some vigil against their impending doom. The next day dawned gray and cheerless, overcast with clouds like ashes in the sky, and into it Covenant rode bent in his saddle as if he had a weight around his neck. His ring had lost its red stain with the setting of the moon, but the color remained in his mind, and the ring seemed to drag him down like a meaningless crime. Helplessly, he perceived that an allegiance he had not chosen, could not have chosen, was being forced upon him. The evidence seemed irrefutable. Like the moon, he was falling prey to Lord Fowl's machinations. His volition was not required. The strings which dangled him were strong enough to overbear any resistance. He did not understand how it could happen to him. Was his death wish, his leper's weariness or despair, so strong? What had become of his obdurate instinct for survival? Where was his anger, his violence? Had he been victimized for so long that now he could only respond as a victim, even to himself? He had no answers. He was sure of nothing but the fear which came over him when the company halted at noon. He found that he did not want to get down from Dura's back. He distrusted the ground, dreaded contact with it. He had lost a fundamental confidence. His faith that the earth was stable, a faith so obvious and constant and necessary that it had been unconscious until now, had been shaken. Blind, silent soil had become a dark hand malevolently seeking out him and him alone. Nevertheless, he swung down from the saddle, forced himself, set foot on the ground, and was stung. The virulence of the sensation made all his nerves cringe, and he could hardly stand as he watched Prothol and Morum and Birinair try to capture what he had felt. But they failed completely. The misery of that ill touch withdrew the instant he jumped away from it. That evening, during supper, he was stung again. When he went to bed to hide his ring from the moon, he shivered as if he were feverish. On the morning of the sixth day, he arose with a gray face and a crippled look in his eyes. Before he could mount Dura, he was stung again. And again, during one of the company's rest halts. And again, the instant he mustered enough despair to dismount at the end of the day's ride. The wrong felt like another spike in his coffin lid. This time his nerves reacted so violently that he tumbled to the ground like a demonstration of futility. He had to lie still for a long time before he could coax his arms and legs under control again, and when he finally regained his feet, he jerked and winced with fear at every step. "Pathetic, pathetic," he panted to himself, but he could not find the rage to master it. With keen concern in his eyes, Foam Follower asked him why he did not take off his boots. Covenant had to think for a moment before he could remember why. Then he murmured, "They're part of me. They're part of the way I have to live. I don't have very many parts left. And besides," he added wanly, "if I don't keep having these fits, how is Prothol going to figure them out?" "Do not do such a thing for us," Morum replied intently. "How could we ask it?" But Covenant only shrugged and went to sit by the fire. He could not face food that night. The thought of eating made his raw nerves nauseous, but he tried a few Aliantha from a bush near the camp and found that they had a calming effect. He ate a handful of the berries, absent-mindedly tossing away the seeds as Lena had taught him, and returned to the fire. When the company had finished its meal, Morum seated himself beside Covenant. Without looking at him, the Lord asked, "How can we help you? Should we build a litter so that you will not have to touch the earth? Or are there other ways? Perhaps one of Foam Follower's tales would ease your heart. I have heard giants boast that the despiser himself would become an earth friend if he could be made to listen to the story of Bagoon the Unbearable and Thelma Two-Fist. Such healing there is in stories." Abruptly, Morum turned squarely toward Covenant, and Covenant saw that the Lord's face was full of sympathy. "I see your pain, Ur-Lord." Covenant hung his head to avoid Morum's gaze, made sure his left hand was securely in his pocket. After a moment, he said distantly, "Tell me about the Creator." "Ah," Morum sighed. "We do not know that a creator lives. Our only lore of such a being comes from the most shadowy reaches of our oldest legends. We know the despiser, but the Creator, we do not know. Then Covenant was vaguely startled to hear Lord Tamarantha cut in, "Of course we know. Ah, the folly of the young. Morum, my son, you are not yet a prophet. You must learn that kind of courage." Slowly she pulled her ancient limbs together and got to her feet, leaning on her staff for support. Her thin white hair hung in wisps about her face as she moved into the circle around the fire, muttering frailly, "Oracles and prophecy are incompatible. According to Kevin's lore, only Harthu, the Lord Fatherer, was both seer and prophet. Lesser souls lose the paradox. Why, I do not know. But when Kevin Landwaster decided in his heart to invoke the ritual of desecration, he saved the Bloodguard and the Ranahin and the Giants because he was an oracle. And because he was no prophet, he failed to see that Lord Fowl would survive. A lesser man than Beric. Of course the Creator lived." She looked over at Varial for confirmation, and he nodded, but Covenant could not tell whether he was approving or drowsing. But Tamarantha nodded in return as if Varial had supported her. Lifting her head to the night sky and the stars, she spoke in a voice fragile with age. "Of course the Creator lives," she repeated. "How else? Opposites require each other. Otherwise the difference is lost, and only chaos remains. No, there can be no despite without creation. Better to ask how the Creator could have forgotten that when he made the earth. For if he did not forget, then creation and despite existed together in his one being, and he did not know it. This the elder legends tell us. Into the infinity before time was made came the Creator, like a worker into his workshop. And since it is the nature of creating to desire perfection, the Creator devoted all himself to the task. First, he built the Arch of Time, so that his creation would have a place in which to be. And for the keystone of that arch, he forged the wild magic, so that time would be able to resist chaos and endure. Then within the arch he formed the earth. For ages he labored, formed and unformed, trialed and tested and rejected and trialed and tested again, so that when he was done his creation would have no cause to reproach him. And when the earth was fair to his eye, he gave birth to the inhabitants of the earth, beings to act out in their lives his reach for perfection. And he did not neglect to give them the means to strive for perfection themselves. When he was done, he was proud as only those who create can be. Alas, he did not understand despite, or had forgotten it. He undertook his task thinking that perfect labor was all that he required to create perfection. And when he was done, and his pride had tasted its first satisfaction, he looked closely at the earth, thinking to gratify himself with the sight, and he was dismayed. For behold, buried deep in the earth through no will or forming of his, were banes of destruction, powers virile enough to rip his masterwork into dust. Then he understood, or remembered. Perhaps he found despite itself beside him, misguiding his hand. Or perhaps he saw the harm in himself. It does not matter. He became outraged with grief and torn pride. In his fury he wrestled with despite, either within him or without, and in his fury he cast the despiser down, out of the infinity of the cosmos, onto the earth. Alas, thus the despiser was imprisoned within time, and thus the Creator's creation became the despiser's world, to torment as he chose. For the very law of time, the principle of power which made the arch possible, worked to preserve Lord Fowl, as we now call him. That law requires that no act may be undone. Desecration may not be undone. Defilement may not be recanted. It may be survived or healed, but not denied. Therefore, Lord Fowl has afflicted the earth, and the Creator cannot stop him, for it was the Creator's act which placed despite here. In sorrow and humility, the Creator saw what he had done. So that the plight of the earth would not be utterly without hope, he sought to help his creation in indirect ways. He guided the Lord Fatherer to the fashioning of the Staff of Law, a weapon against despite. But the very law of the earth's creation permits nothing more. If the Creator were to silence Lord Fowl, that act would destroy time, and then the despiser would be free in infinity again, free to make whatever befoulments he desired. Tamarantha paused. She had told her tale simply, without towering rhetoric or agitation or any sign of passion beyond her agedness. But for a moment, her thin old voice convinced Covenant that the universe was at stake, that his own struggle was only a microcosm of a far larger conflict. During that moment, he waited in suspense for what she would say next. Shortly, she lowered her head and turned her wrinkled gaze full on him. Almost whispering, she said, "Thus, we are come to the greatest test. The wild magic is here. With a word, our world could be riven to the core." "Do not mistake," she quavered. "If we cannot win this unbeliever to our cause, then the earth will end in rubble." But Covenant could not tell whether her voice shook because she was old or because she was afraid. Moonrise was near. He went to his bed to avoid exposing the alteration of his ring. With his head under the blankets, he stared into the blackness, saw when the moon came up by the bloody glow which grew in his wedding band. The metal seemed more deeply stained than it had 2 nights ago. It held his covered gaze like a fixation, and when he finally slept, he was as exhausted as if he had been worn out under an interrogation. The next morning, he managed to reach Dura's back without being attacked, and he groaned in unashamed relief. Then Prothol broke his usual habit and did not call for a halt at noon. The reason became clear when the riders topped a rise and came in sight of the Soul's Ease River. They rode down out of the harsh plains and swam their horses across the river before stopping to rest. And there again, Covenant was not attacked when he set foot on the ground. But the rest of the day contrasted grimly with this inexplicable respite. A few leagues beyond the Soul's Ease, the quest came upon a waymeet for the first time. Remembering Covenant's tale of a murdered Wayanhim, Prothol sent 2 Bloodguard, Korik and Terrell, who warded Lord Morum, into the waymeet. The investigation was only necessary for confirmation. Even Covenant, in his straitened condition, could see the neglect, smell the disuse. The green traveler's haven had gone brown and sour. When Korik and Terrell returned, they could only report what the company had already perceived. The waymeet was untended. The lords met this discovery with stern faces. Clearly they had feared that the murder Covenant had described would lead the Wayanhim to end their service. But several of the warriors groaned in shock and dismay, and Foam Follower ground his teeth. Covenant glanced around at the giant, and for a moment saw Foam Follower's face suffused with fury. The expression passed quickly, but it left Covenant feeling shaken. Unexpectedly, he sensed that the unmarred loyalty of the giants to the land was dangerous. It was quick to judge. So there was a gloom on the company at the end of the 7th day, a gloom which could only be aggravated by the moon, incarnadine and corrupt, as it colored the night like a conviction of disaster. Only Covenant received any relief. Once again, his private, stalking ill left him alone. But the next day brought the riders in sight of Andalane. Their path lay along the outskirts of the hills on the southwest side, and even through the hanging gray weather, the richness of Andalane glistened like the proudest gem of the earth. It made the company feel light-boned, affected the quest like a living view of what the land had been like before the desecration. Covenant needed that quiet consolation as much as anyone, but it was denied him. While eating breakfast, he had been bitten again by the wrong in the earth. The previous day's respite seemed only to multiply the virulence of the attack. It was compact with malevolence, as if that respite had frustrated it, intensified its spite. The sensation of wrong left him foundering. During one of the rest halts, he was struck again. And that evening, while he made himself a supper of Aliantha, he was struck again. This time the wrong lashed him so viciously that he passed out for some time. When he regained consciousness, he was lying in Foam Follower's arms like a child. He felt vaguely that he had had convulsions. "Take off your boots," Foam Follower urged intently. Numbness filled Covenant's head like mist, clouded his reactions, but he mustered the lucidity to ask, "Why? Why? Stone and sea, my friend. When you ask like that, how can I answer? Ask yourself, what do you gain by enduring such wrong?" "Myself," he murmured faintly. He wanted simply to recline in the giant's arms and sleep, but he fought the desire, pushed himself away from Foam Follower until the giant set him on his feet by Birinair's Lilianral fire. For a moment he had to cling decrepitly to Foam Follower's arm to support himself, but then one of the warriors gave him his staff, and he braced himself on it. By resisting. But he knew in his bones that he was not resisting. They felt weak, as if they were melting under the strain. His boots had become a hollow symbol for an intransigence he no longer felt. Foam Follower started to object, but Morum stopped him. "It is his choice," the Lord said softly. After a while, Covenant fell into feverish sleep. He did not know that he was carried tenderly to bed, did not know that Morum watched over him during the night, and saw the bloody stain on his wedding band. He reached some sort of crisis while he slept, and awoke with the feeling that he had lost, that his ability to endure had reached the final either-or of a toss which had gone against him. His throat was parched like a battleground. When he forced his eyes open, he found himself again prostrated in Foam Follower's arms. Around him, the company was ready to mount for the day's ride. When he saw Covenant's eyes open, Foam Follower bent over him and said quietly, "I would rather bear you in my arms than see you suffer. Our journey to Lord's Keep was easier for me than watching you now." Part of Covenant rallied to look at the giant. Foam Follower's face showed strain, but it was not the strain of exhaustion. Rather, it seemed like a pressure building up in his mind, a pressure that made the fortress of his forehead appear to bulge. Covenant stared at it dumbly for a long moment before he realized that it was sympathy. The sight of his own pain made Foam Follower's pulse throb in his temples. "Giant," Covenant breathed to himself. "Are they all like this?" Watching that concentration of emotion, he murmured, "What's a Foam Follower?" The giant did not appear to notice the irrelevance of the question. "A follower is a compass," he answered simply. "So, Foam Follower, see compass." Covenant began weakly moving, trying to get out of the giant's arms. But Foam Follower held him, forbade him in silence to set his feet on the ground. Lord Morum intervened. With grim determination in his voice, he said, "Set him down." "Down," Covenant echoed. Several retorts passed under Foam Follower's heavy brows, but he only said, "Why?" "I have decided," Morum replied. We will not move from this place until we understand what is happening to Ur-Lord Covenant. I have delayed this risk too long. Death gathers around us. Set him down. His eyes flashed dangerously. Still, Foamfollower hesitated until he saw High Lord Prothol nod support for Morum. Then he turned Covenant upright and lowered him gently to the ground. For an instant, his hands rested protectively on Covenant's shoulders. Then he stepped back. "Now, Ur-Lord," said Morum, "give me your hand. We will stand together until you feel the ill, and I feel it through you." At that, a coil of weak panic writhed in Covenant's heart. He saw himself reflected in Morum's eyes, saw himself standing lornly with what he had lost written in his face. That loss dismayed him. In that tiny, reflected face, he perceived abruptly that if the attacks continued, he would inevitably learn to enjoy the sense of horror and loathing which they gave him. He had discovered a frontier into the narcissism of revulsion, and Morum was asking him to risk crossing over. "Come," the Lord urged, extending his right hand. "We must understand this wrong if we are to resist it." In desperation or despair, Covenant thrust out his hand. The heels of their palms met. They gripped each other's thumbs. His two fingers felt weak, hopeless for Morum's purpose, but the Lord's grasp was sturdy. Hand to hand like combatants, they stood there as though they were about to wrestle with some bitter ghoul. The attack came almost at once. Covenant cried out, shook as if his bones were gibbering, but he did not leap away. In the first instant, Morum's hard grip sustained him. Then the Lord threw his arm around Covenant, clasped him to his chest. The violence of Covenant's distress buffeted Morum, but he held his ground, gritted his embrace. As suddenly as it had come, the attack passed. With a groan, Covenant sagged in Morum's arms. Morum held him up until he moved and began to carry his own weight. Then, slowly, the Lord released him. For a moment, their faces appeared oddly similar. They had the same haunted expression, the same sweat, damp, hollow gaze. But shortly, Covenant gave a shuddering sigh, and Morum straightened his shoulders, and the similarity faded. "I was a fool," Morum breathed. "I should have known. That ill is Drool Rockworm, reaching out with the power of the staff to find you. He can sense your presence by the touch of your boots on the earth, because they are unlike anything made in the land. Thus, he knows where you are, and so where we are. It is my guess that you were untouched the day we crossed the Soul's Ease because Drool expected us to move toward him on the river and was searching for us on water rather than on land. But he learned his mistake and regained contact with you yesterday." The Lord paused, gave what he was saying a chance to penetrate Covenant. Then he concluded, "Ur-Lord, for the sake of us all, for the sake of the land, you must not wear your boots. Drool already knows too much of our movements. His servants are abroad." Covenant did not respond. Morum's words seemed to sap the last of his strength. The trial had been too much for him. With a sigh, he fainted into the Lord's arms. So we did not see how carefully his boots and clothes were removed and packed in Dura's saddlebags, how tenderly his limbs were washed by the Lord's and dressed in a robe of white samite, how sadly his ring was taken from his finger and placed on a new patch of Klingor over his heart, how gently he was cradled in Saltheart Foamfollower's arms throughout the long march of that day. He lay in darkness like a sacrifice. He could hear the teeth of his leprosy devouring his flesh. There was a smell of contempt around him, insisting on his impotence. But his lips were bowed in a placid smile, a look of fondness, as if he had come at last to approve his disintegration. He continued to smile when he awoke late that night and found himself staring into the wide ghoul grin of the moon. Slowly, His smile stretched into a taut grimace, a look of happiness or hatred. But then the moon was blocked out of his vision by Foam Follower's great bulk. The giant's huge palms, each as large as Covenant's face, stroked his head tenderly, and in time the caress had its effect on him. His eyes lost their ghastly appearance, and his face relaxed, drifted away from torment into repose. Soon, he was deep in a less perilous slumber. The next day, the 10th of the quest, he awoke calmly as if he were held in numb truce or stasis between irreconcilable demands. A feeling of affectlessness pervaded him, as if he no longer had the heart to care about himself. Yet he was hungry. He ate a large breakfast and remembered to thank the Woodhelvenin woman who seemed to have assigned herself the task of providing for him. His new apparel he accepted with a rueful shrug, noticing in silent, dim sarcasm how easily, after all, he was able to shed himself, and how the white robe flattered his gaunt form as if he were born to it. Then, dumbly, he mounted Dura. His companions watched him as if they feared he would fall. He was weaker than he had realized. He needed most of his concentration to keep his seat, but he was equal to the task. Gradually, the questers began to believe that he was out of danger. Among them, he rode through the sunshine and the warm spring air along the flowered marge of Andalane, rode attenuated and careless, as if he were locked between impossibilities. Chapter 17. End in Fire. That night, the company camped in a narrow valley between two rocky hillsides half a league from the thick grasses of Andalane. The warriors were cheery, recovering their natural spirits after the tensions of the past few days, and they told stories and sang songs to the quiet audience of the lords and Bloodguard. Though the lords did not participate, they seemed glad to listen, and several times Moram and Quan could be heard chuckling together. But Covenant did not share the ebullience of the yeoman. A heavy hand of blankness held shut the lid of his emotions, and he felt separate, untouchable. Finally, he went to his bed before the warriors were done with their last song. He was awakened some time later by a hand on his shoulder. Opening his eyes, he found Foam Follower stooping beside him. The moon had nearly set. "Arise," the giant whispered. "The Ranian have brought word. Wolves are hunting us. Urvile's may not be far behind. We must go." Covenant blinked sleepily at the giant's benighted face for a moment. "Why? Won't they follow?" "Make haste, Urlord. Tero, Korik, and perhaps a third of Quan's yeomen will remain here in ambush. They will scatter the pack. Come." But Covenant persisted. "So what? They'll just fall back and follow again. Let me sleep." "My friend, you try my patience. Arise, and I will explain." With a sigh, Covenant rolled from his blankets. While he tightened the sash of his robe, settled his sandals on his feet, and assured himself of his staff and knife, his Woodhelvenin helper snatched up his bedding and packed it away. Then she led Dura toward him. Amid the silent urgency of the company, he mounted, then went with Foam Follower toward the center of the camp, where the lords and Bloodguard were already mounted. When the warriors were ready, Birinair extinguished the last embers of the fire and climbed stiffly onto his horse. A moment later, the riders turned and fled the narrow valley, picking their way across the rough terrain by the last red light of the moon. The ground under Dura's hooves looked like blood slowly clotting, and Covenant clutched his ring to preserve it from the crimson light. Around him, the company moved in a tight suspense of silence. Every low, metal clatter of sword was instantly muffled, every breath covered. The Ranahin were as noiseless as shadows, and on their broad backs the Bloodguard sat like statues, eternally alert and insentient. Then the moon set. Darkness was a relief, though it seemed to increase the hazard of their escape. that the whole company was surrounded, guided by the Ranian, and the mighty horses chose a path which kept the other mounts safe between them. After 2 or 3 leagues had passed, the mood of the quest relaxed somewhat. They heard no pursuit, sensed no danger. Finally, Foam Follower gave Covenant the explanation he had promised. "It is simple," the giant whispered. "After scattering the wolves, Korik and Terrell will lead a trail away from ours. They will go straight into Andalane, east toward Mount Thunder, until pursuit has been confused. Then they will turn and rejoin us." "Why?" Covenant asked softly. Lord Moram took up the explanation. "We doubt that Druul can understand our purpose." Covenant could not feel the Lord's presence as strongly as Foam Followers, so Moram's voice sounded disembodied in the darkness, as if the night were speaking. That impression seemed to belie his words, as if without the verification of physical presence, what the Lord said was vain. "Much of our quest may seem foolhardy or foolish to him. Since he holds the staff, we are mad to approach him. But if we mean to approach nonetheless, then our southward path is folly, for it is long, and his power grows daily. He will expect us to turn east toward him, or south toward Doom's retreat and escape. Korik and Terrell will give Druul's scouts reason to believe that we have turned to attack. If he becomes unsure of where we are, he will not guess our true aim. He will search for us in Andalane, and will seek to strengthen his defenses in Mount Thunder. Believing that we have turned to attack him, he will also believe that we have mastered the power of your white gold." Covenant considered momentarily before asking, "What's Foul going to be doing during all this?" "Ah," Moram sighed, "that is a question. There hangs the fate of our quest, and of the land." He was silent for a long time. "In my dreams, I see him laughing." Covenant winced at the memory of Fowl's crushing laughter and fell silent. So the riders crept on through the dark, trusting themselves to the instincts of the Ranahin. When dawn came, they had left their ambush for the wolves far behind. It took the company 4 more days of hard riding, 15 leagues a day, to reach the Mithil River, the southern boundary of Andalane. For 60 leagues, the quest drove to the southeast without a hint of what had befallen Korik's group. In all, only 8 people had left the company. But somehow, without them, the quest seemed shrunken and puny. The concern of the High Lord and his companions rumbled in the hoofbeats of their mounts and echoed in the silence that lay between them like an empty bier. Gone now was the gladness of eye with which the warriors had beheld Andalane never more than a league to their left. From dawn to dusk, every glance studied the eastern horizons. They saw nothing but a void in which Korik's riders had not appeared. Time and again, Foam Follower broke away from the company to trot up the nearest hill and peer into the distance. Time and again he returned panting and comfortless, and the company was left to conceive nightmares to explain Korik's absence. The unspoken consensus was that no number of wolves was large enough to conquer 2 Bloodguard, mounted as they were on Hurin and Braba of the Ranahin. No, Korik's group must have fallen into the hands of a small army of Urviles. So the company reasoned, though Prothol argued that Korik might have had to ride many leagues to find a river or other means to throw the wolves off his trail. The High Lord's words were sound, but somehow under the incarnadine moon they seemed hollow. In spite of them, Warhaft Quan went about his duties with the deaths of 6 warriors in his face. All the riders were shrouded in gloom when, near twilight on the 4th day, they reached the banks of the Mithil. Immediately on their left, as they neared the river, stood a steep hill like a boundary of Andalane. It guarded the north bank. The company could only cross its base into Andalane by riding single file along the river edge. But Prothol chose that path in preference to swimming the stiff current of the Mithil. With only Tuvor before him, he led the way east along the scant bank. The questers followed one by one. Soon the entire company was traversing the boundary of the hill. Spread out as they were vulnerable. As the hill rose beside them, its slope became almost sheer, and its rocky crown commanded the path along the river like a fortification. The riders moved with their heads craned upward. They were keenly conscious of the hazard of their position. They were still in the traverse when they heard a hail from the hilltop. Among the rocks, a figure rose into view. It was Terrell. The riders returned his hail joyfully. Hurrying, they crossed the base of the hill and found themselves in a broad, grassy valley where horses, 2 Ronihan and 5 Mustangs, grazed up away from the river. The Mustangs were exhausted. Their legs quivered weakly and their necks drooped. They barely had strength enough to eat. 5, Covenant repeated. He felt numbly sure that he had miscounted. Korik was on his way down from the hilltop. He was accompanied by 5 warriors. With an angry shout, Quan leaped from his horse and ran toward the Bloodguard. Irin, he demanded. Where is Irin? By the 7. What has happened to her? Korik did not answer until he stood with his group before High Lord Prothol. They struck Covenant as a strange combination. 5 warriors full of conflicting excitement, courage, grief, and 1 Bloodguard as impassive as a patriarch. If Korik felt any satisfaction or pain, he did not show it. He held a bulging pack in one hand, but did not refer to it immediately. Instead, he saluted Prothol and said, High Lord, you are well. Have you been pursued?
We have seen no pursuit,
Prothol replied gravely. That is good. It appeared to us that we were successful. Prothol nodded, and Korik began his tale. We met the wolves and sought to scatter them. But they were Kresh. He made a splitting sound, not easily turned aside. So we led them eastward. They would not enter Andalane. They howled on our track, but would not enter. We watched from a distance until they turned away to the north. Then we rode east. After a day and a night, we broke trail and turned south. But we came upon marauders. They were mightier than we knew. There were Urviles and Cave Whites together, and with them, a griffin. Korik's audience murmured with surprise and chagrin, and the Bloodguard paused to utter what sounded like a long curse in the tonal native tongue of the Haruchai. Then he continued, Irin purchased our escape, but we were driven far from our way. We reached this place only a short time before you. With a revolted flaring of his nostrils, he lifted the pack. This morning, we saw a hawk over us. It flew strangely. We shot it. Reaching into the pack, he drew out the body of the bird. Above its vicious beak, it had only 1 eye, a large, mad orb centered in its forehead. It struck the company with radiated malice. The hawk was ill, incondign, a thing created by wrong for purposes of wrong, bent away from its birth by a power that dared to warp nature. The sight stuck in Covenant's throat made him want to retch. He could hardly hear Prothol say, This is the work of the ill earth stone. How could the staff of law perform such a crime, such an outrage? Ah, my friends, this is the outcome of our enemy. Look closely. It is a mercy to take such creatures out of life. Abruptly, the High Lord turned away, burdened by his new knowledge. Quan and Birinair cremated the ill-formed hawk. Soon the warriors who had gone with Korik began to talk, and a fuller picture of their past 4 days emerged. Attention naturally centered on the fight which had killed Irin of the Yeoman. The Ronihan Braba had first smelled danger and had given the warning to Korik. At once he had hidden his group in a thick copse to await the coming of the marauders. Listening with his ear to the ground, he had judged that they were a mixed force of unmounted Urviles and Cave Whites. Cave Whites had not the Urviles' ability to step softly, totaling no more than 15. So Korik had asked himself which way his service lay, to preserve his companions as defenders of the lords, or to damage the lord's enemies. The Bloodguard were sworn to the protection of the lords, not of the land. He had elected to fight because he judged that his force was strong enough, considering the element of surprise, to meet both duties without loss of life. His decision had saved them. They learned later that if they had not attacked, they would have been trapped in the copse. The panic of the horses would have given away their hiding. It was a dark night after moonset, the second night after Korik's group had left the company, and the marauders were moving without lights. Even the Blood Guard's keen eyes discerned nothing more than the shadowy outlines of the enemy, and the wind blew between the two forces so that the Runahin were prevented from smelling the extent of their peril. When the marauders reached open ground, Korik signaled to his group. The warriors swept out of the copse behind him and Terrell. The Runahin outdistanced the others at once, so Korik and Terrell had just engaged the enemy when they heard the terror screams of the horses. Wheeling around, the Bloodguard saw all six warriors struggling with their panicked steeds, and the griffin hovering over them. The griffin was a lion-like creature with sturdy wings that enabled it to fly for short distances. It terrified the horses, swooped at the riders. Korik and Terrell raced toward their comrades, and behind them came the marauders. The Bloodguard hurled themselves at the griffin, but aloft, with its clawed feet downward, it had no vulnerable spots that they could reach without weapons. Then the marauders fell on the group. The warriors rallied to defend their horses. In the melee, Korik poised himself on Braba's back to swing up at the griffin at the first opportunity. But when his chance came, Irin cut in front of him. Somehow she had captured a long, cave-whitish broadsword. The griffin snatched her up in its claws, and as it ripped her apart, she beheaded it. The next moment, another party of marauders charged forward. The warriors' horses were too terrified to do anything but run. So Korik's group fled, dashed east and north with the enemy on their heels. By the time they lost the pursuit, they had been driven so far into Andalane that they had not been able to rejoin Prothol until the fourth day. Early in the evening, the reunited company set up camp. While they prepared supper, a cool wind slowly mounted out of the north. At first it felt refreshing, full of Andalanian scents. But as moonrise neared, it stiffened with a palpable wrench until it was scything straight through the valley. Covenant could taste its unnaturalness. He had felt something like it before. Like a whip, it drove dark cloud banks southward. As the evening wore on, no one seemed inclined toward sleep. Depression deepened in the company as if the wind were taut with dismay. On opposite sides of the camp, Foam Follower and Quan paced out their uneasiness. Most of the warriors squatted around in dejected attitudes, fiddling aimlessly with their weapons. Birinair poked in unrelieved dissatisfaction at the fire. Prothol and Morum stood squarely in the wind as if they were trying to read it with the nerves of their faces, and Covenant sat with his head bowed under a flurry of memories. Only Varyal and Tamarantha remained ungloomed. Arm in arm, the two ancient lords sat and stared with a dreaming, drowsy look into the fire, and the firelight flickered like writing on their foreheads. Around the camp, the Bloodguard stood as stolid as stone. Finally, Morum voiced the feeling of the company. Something happens. Something dire. This is no natural wind. Under the clouds, the eastern horizon glowed red with moonlight. From time to time, Covenant thought he saw an orange flicker in the crimson, but he could not be sure. Covertly, he studied his ring and found the same occasional orange cast under the dominating blood. But he said nothing. He was too ashamed of Drool's hold on him. Still no storm came. The wind blew on, rife with red mutterings and old ice, but it brought nothing but clouds and discouragement to the company. At last, most of the warriors dozed fitfully, shivering against the cut of the wind as it bore its harvest of distress toward Doom's retreat and the Southron wastes. There was no dawn. Clouds choked the rising sun. But the company was roused by a change in the wind. It dropped and warmed, swung slowly toward the west. But it did not feel healthier, only more subtle. Several of the warriors rolled out of their blankets, clutching their swords. The company ate in haste, impelled by the indefinite apprehension of the breeze. The old Hirebrand, Birinair, was the first to understand. While chewing a mouthful of bread, he suddenly jerked erect as if he had been slapped. Quivering with concentration, he glowered at the eastern horizon, then spat the bread to the ground. "Burning," he hissed. "The wind. I smell it. Burning. What? I can smell burning. A tree. A tree," he wailed. "Ah, they dare." For an instant, the company stared at him in silence. Then Morum ejaculated, "Soaring wood elven is in flames." His companions sprang into action. Shrilly, the blood guard whistled for the Ranahin. Prothol snapped orders which Quan echoed in a raw shout. Some of the warriors sprinted to saddle the horses, while others broke camp. By the time Covenant was dressed and mounted on Dura, the quest was ready to ride. At once, it galloped away eastward along the Mythal. Before long, the horses began to give trouble. Even the freshest ones could not keep pace with the Ranahin, and the mustangs which had been with Korik in Andalane had not recovered their strength. The terrain did not allow for speed. It was too uneven. Prothol sent two Bloodguard ahead as scouts. But after that, he was forced to move more slowly. He could not afford to leave part of his force behind. Still, he kept the pace as fast as possible. It was a frustrating ride. Covenant seemed to hear Quan grinding his teeth, but it could not be helped. Grimly, Prothol held the fresher horses back. By noon, they reached the ford of the Mythal. Now they could see smoke due south of them, and the smell of burning was powerful in the air. Prothol commanded a halt to water the horses. Then the riders pushed on, urging their weakest mounts to find somewhere new resources of strength and speed. Within a few leagues, the High Lord had to slow his pace still more. The scouts had not returned. The possibility that they had been ambushed clenched his brow, and his eyes glittered as if the orbs had facets of granite. He held the riders to a walk while he sent two more Bloodguard ahead. These two returned before the company had covered a league. They reported that Soaring Woodhelven was dead. The area around it was deserted. Signs indicated that the first two scouts had ridden away to the south. Muttering "Melancurian" under his breath, Prothol led the riders forward at a canter until they reached the remains of the tree village. The destruction was a fiendish piece of work. Fire had reduced the original tree to smoldering spars less than 100 feet tall, and the charred trunk had been split from top to bottom, leaving the two halves leaning slightly away from each other. Occasional flames still flickered near their tips, and all around the base of the tree, corpses littered the ground as if the earth were already too full of dead to contain the population of the village. Other Woodhelven bodies, unburned, were scattered generally in a line to the south across the glade. Along this southward line, a few dead cavewights sprawled in battle contortion, but near the tree there was only one body which was not human. One dead Ervile. It lay on its long back on the south of the tree, facing the split trunk, and its soot-black frame was as twisted as the iron stave still clutched in its hands. Nearby lay a heavy iron plate nearly 10 feet across. The stench of dead, burned flesh appalled the surrounding glade. A memory of the Woodhelven and children writhed in Covenant's guts. He felt like vomiting. The Lord seemed stupefied by the sight, stunned to realize that people under their care could be so murdered. After a moment, First Mark Tuvor reconstructed the battle for them. The folk of Soaring Woodhelven had not had a chance. Late the previous day, Tuvor judged, a large party of cavewights and Ervils, The trampling of the glade attested that the party was very large, had surrounded the tree. They had kept out of effective arrow range. Instead of assaulting the Wood Elven indirectly, they sent a few of their number, almost certainly Urvile's, forward under cover of the iron plate. Thus protected, the Urvile's set flame to the tree. "A poor fire," Birinair inserted. Approaching the tree, he tapped it with his staff. A patch of charcoal fell away, showing white wood underneath. "Strong fire consumes everything," he muttered. "Almost, they survived. This is good wood. Make the flame a little weaker, and the wood survives. Those who dared. Only strong enough by a little. Numbers are nothing. Strength counts, of course. A narrow chance. Or if the Hirebrand had known, been ready, he could have prepared the tree, given it strength. They could have lived. Ah, I should have been here. They would not do this to wood in my care." Once the fire began, Tuvor explained, the attackers simply shot arrows to prevent the flames from being put out, and waited for the desperate Wood Helvenin to attempt escape. Hence the line of unburned bodies running southward. That was the direction taken by the sortie. Then, when the fire was too great for the Wood Helvenin to resist further, the Urvile Loremaster split the tree to destroy it utterly and to shake any survivors from its limbs. Again Birinair spoke. "He learned. Retribution. The fool. Not master of his own power. The tree struck him down. Good wood. Even burning, it was not dead. The Hirebrand. A brave man. Struck back. And before the desecration, the Lilianro could have saved what life is left." He scowled as if he dared anyone to criticize him. "No more. This I cannot." But a moment later his imperiousness faded, and he turned sadly back to gaze on the ruined tree as if silently asking it to forgive him. Covenant did not question Tuvor's analysis. He felt too sickened by the blood-thick reek around him. But Foam Follower did not seem affected in that way. Dully, he asserted, "This is not Druul's doing. No cave-white is the master of such strategy. Winds and clouds to disguise the signs of attack, should any help be near. Iron protection carried here from who knows what distance. An attack with so little waste of resource. No. The hand of Soul Crusher is here from first to last. Stone and sea." Without warning, his voice caught and he turned away, groaning his giantish plainsong to steady himself. Into the silence, Quan asked, "But why here?" There was an edge like panic in his voice. "Why attack this place?" Something in Quan's tone, some hint of hysteria among brave but inexperienced, appalled young warriors, called Prothol back from the Wilderland where his thoughts wandered. Responding to Quan's emotion rather than to his question, the High Lord said sternly, "Warhaft Quan, there is much work to be done. The horses will rest, but we must work. Burial must be dug for the dead. After their last ordeal, it would be unfitting to set them to the pyre. Put your yeomen to the task. Dig graves in the south glade. There." He indicated a spread of grass about 100 feet from the riven tree. "We," he referred to his fellow lords, "we will carry the dead to their graves." Foam Follower interrupted his plain song. "No, I will carry. Let me show my respect." "Very well," Prothol replied. "We will prepare food and consider our situation." With a nod, he sent Quan to give orders to the yeoman. Then, turning to Tuvor, he asked that sentries be posted. Tuvor observed that 8 Bloodguard were not enough to watch every possible approach to an open area as large as the glade, but if he sent the Ranahin roaming separately around the bordering hills, he might not need to call on the yeomen for assistance. After a momentary pause, the First Mark asked what should be done about the missing scouts.
"We will wait,"
Prothol responded heavily. Tuvor nodded and moved away.